Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Paul M. from Feet for Speakers Group, Quakertown, Pennsylvania.
To make sure my ringer's off. Hi, everyone. My name's Paul, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 28, 2007. My home group is here, Feet First Speakers Group. I was thinking how long I've been a home group member here, and I'm drawing a blank. It's probably somewhere around four plus years. When I came to this home group, I was coming back into AA. I had experienced sobriety for about 2.5 years, from October 2nd of 2002 until I decided to, continue to run my life. And it didn't take long after that decision for me to get back here. Like I said, I spent 2.5 years. Basically just not drinking and not drugging. Drugs are a big part of my story. I'm not going to talk about them in any major extent, but know one thing. When I was young, a teenager, and this is how sick I was, my thought then was, if I ever do heroin, I'm going to quit. So we'll continue from there. I grew up up in the Lehigh Valley, not far from here. Was a very self-centered person from day one. From my earliest memories, I can remember just always needing to be the center of attention. I was the class clown. I was always, having to be in everybody's face. It was just what I did. And I didn't understand it. I didn't know why. It was just the way it was, I was the kid that I would never try to hurt anyone on purpose, but I would always hurt you because of my actions and things I did and said and the way I acted. But see, I did everything to hurt myself too. It wasn't just you. I did things that, could have killed me in a heartbeat, I was thinking, I have so many, memories of my self-centeredness and my selfishness and my insanity. And I spoke about this at a meeting once when I shared, and it was about out in New York. And I shared about how when I was young in my teens, we used to do a lot of quarry swimming up north because we have mine holes everywhere. And with a mine hole in the ground, there's cliffs. And we started, swimming in these mine holes, and we started diving off these cliffs. And I was, being taken to this mine hole, this quarry, when I was, 8, 9 years old with a bar of soap. My buddy's dad, we'd go there, and we'd bathe, and we'd get, clean off, and we'd go back to the house. And he used to always tell me, don't ever jump off these cliffs. If you're going to go off them, dive. And I never left my mind. It always stayed in my head. So we used to go and party at these quarries because, they were in the middle of nowhere. We weren't offending anybody. We'd carry a half barrel of keg to the number 4 cliff of Felix's Quarry in Ormrod, and 5 guys in 8th grade would drink a half barrel of beer. And that's pretty insane, if you ask me. And then we'd go off the cliffs. We'd have the annual burning of the underwear. And, just stupid stuff, but ceremonial things, And we'd start going off these cliffs, and just crazy. But there was one cliff called The Point. It was 75 feet high. And nobody would ever go off it. And then the one day, we had a huge bash, 350 people. We had a couple cars there that we would take sledgehammers to, we'd pull them in and take sledgehammers to cars for fun, things like that, just stupid stuff. But we went to the quarry that day, and I had gone off the point before. I had jumped off the point, and the place was filled with people. And I looked out off the point, and the whole cliff on the other side was covered with people. The whole dock was covered with people. And everybody's screaming, jump, jump, jump. And I'm like, F jumping. And I dove 75 feet in the water. And I realized what Pop always meant when he told me, don't ever jump, always dive. It's a lot easier to dive. And but the feeling I had when I came up out of that water that day was the same feeling I had when I consumed alcohol. Everyone is watching me. Look at this. They're all cheering for me. It was all about my ego, all about building me up. Look at me. Look at what I can do. Look what I'll do and you won't do. You know, like, and, you know, when I apply that to my past, it happened all the time. You know, it was just a pattern. And it was a really bad pattern. But it took a lot of pain and a lot of suffering to realize and to be able to see that pattern. And then have the courage and the honesty and a program to change everything about me, to never have to live that way again. And that's what this program's done for me. You know, I'm kind of jumping around, and I'm going to go back a little bit because I have to talk about my self-centeredness, my ego, and my pride, because that's what almost killed me hundreds of times, I'd imagine. You know, I was captain of my wrestling team. I was president of my class. I dated all the cheerleaders. It was all that ego stuff. When there was a fight, I was always the one that everybody came for, that wanted me out front. See, because nobody was too big. You know, my motto was, the bigger you are, the hotter you fall. You know, and it didn't matter if I fell. I'm a short, stocky little kid. I don't have far to go, you know. So that's the way I looked at it. And if you get close enough, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, because I have a face covered with scars. And a body covered with scars. You may not see them, but I'll leave it at that. I do have the war wounds to prove how sick and crazy I acted and what I did, you know. But I had a few things happen in my life that made me realize that things weren't going so well, you know. I went away to college after high school, where I was, you know, of course, the president and captain of the wrestling team, best wrestling team the school's ever had, you know, all that stuff. And went away to college. But, well, back up. I was also really popular in high school because I had a lot of things that people wanted, things I could carry in my pockets, that I could carry in the car. People from Votech wanted them. People, the jocks wanted it. Everybody in my school wanted what I had. And when I figured it out, I kept getting it because I wanted to be the main man. I wanted to be the man. And thank God I was never arrested for what I was doing, because I would have had a different path in my life. And it did get close one time when I was in college. But, you know, I rarely paid consequences. And because of not ever having to pay consequences, I never thought I would. I thought I was above all of it, you know, because of my ego and my pride and my self-centeredness. I went away to college and became very popular very fast in college because of what I had in my pockets, you know. And I did very well in school for the first three semesters, and then not so well, you know, because I found it was easier to bartend and make money than to study and acquire an education. See, because I didn't think any of it really mattered. Because, see, I thought, and what I thought is all that mattered. I was never capable of hearing anything anybody else had to say because of my ego and my pride, you know. It was really, now when I look back at it, painful then. And I look back, and it was all fear. I was afraid of everything. But I couldn't show it, ever. I just couldn't show it. Couldn't let you see me with the sweat of beads of sweat on my forehead. So I always acted out to take the attention off of the beads of sweat on my forehead, and you look at whatever else is going on. you know, because that's how fearful I really was. When I went away to college, you know, I spent 5 years at college, and after my fifth year of college, I found out that all that lack of effort on my part deemed me to spend another semester to get a bachelor's of science degree. And I was like, darn it, I really don't want to have to do that. And I got a phone call from a buddy of mine who I grew up with in high school. He had left and became a welding apprentice down in Norfolk, Virginia, welding submarines. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I just got out of school for, you know, I just finished my fifth year and still don't have my diploma. But, you know, I'm building decks at Dorney Park for the summer. And he said, well, why don't you come up here to Wall Street tomorrow morning and I'll have a couple people I want you to meet. I said, hey, that sounds pretty cool. I'll do that. So I got in the car and I drove up to Wall Street on a Friday. No, it was a Thursday in March 2008. Sat down, met a few people, and they asked me if I wanted to start work with them at $250 a week. I did the math, and I'm like, not really, but okay, you know, because it was a foot in the door. And I drove home. That next day was Friday. I wore one of Kevin's suits to work on Wall Street on Friday so I could go into work. And then I came home for the weekend, and I said, Mom, Dad, I'm going to Wall Street. I got a job. And I set off on a venture that I wish I was sober for, but unfortunately I wasn't, because this part of my story was a lot of fun, but then it ended in a lot of tragedy, and we'll hear about that because I'm going to tell you. So I went up to Wall Street, and on my way up there, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I really believe that I'm meant to be a bartender on a cruise ship. I really believe I should be in a thatched hut on a Caribbean island and be the best bartender I could possibly be. And that's what was going through my head on my way to Wall Street. So I get there and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, if I don't, and I set a number, an insane number, to make in 1 year, in 52 weeks. And if I didn't do that, make that number of money, I was going to become a bartender on a Caribbean island or on a cruise ship. Well, you know, once I got to Wall Street and I found out that I could cheat and lie and steal, I got to that number. And then I got to the next number. And then I got to the next number. And then it was impossible to leave because I had bought a 43-acre estate in Upper Bucks County. I had a car collection. I had a gun collection. I had a trophy wife. I had three beautiful children. I had all this stuff in the world that I just kept acquiring and thinking that that was what life was about, stuff. And, you know, I used to talk about my 54-gun safe, and I had, like, 48 guns in it, you know, and I was going to buy another safe bigger, and then that was going to be the safe just to hold my ammo. You know, like, who needs 54 guns, you know, like that was just the insanity, you know. I had a big barn, you know. I had a man cave in my barn. And that man cave, you know, I had my caddy convertible, 65 caddy convertible. I had my gun collection. I had all my stuff in my barn. The house was the wife's, the stone farmhouse, and the barn was Paul's. And I don't have it anymore. I don't have the wife either. But we'll get to that. So this whole self-centeredness, this whole ego pride thing on stuff, I need more, I got to have more, I thought was making me happy, joyous, and free when it was keeping me in bondage. And I just kept beating myself up every day because I thought I had to have more. And it was really a horrible existence. I I loved my floor. I was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. All right, the thing you see on TV when you see the guys in badges and on the trading floor with the big TV screen screaming and yelling. That's what I did. My life was so insane that I was able, and my head was so insane that I was able to do an insane job. There's only 1,366 of us on the face of the earth. Ego, pride, self-centeredness. And I became very good at what I did, and I made a lot of money doing what I did. And never saw God in any of it. Never saw God, never thanked God. I went to church, you know. My children are in Catholic school, and I go to church on Sunday, but it was all about Paul. It was never about you. It was never about my brothers and my sisters. It was always about me, myself, and I. And I had a lot of lessons to learn, and a very hard one to learn. And I did. And I thank God for that lesson today. And I'll get into the lesson. While I'm on Wall Street, acquiring all this stuff, stepping on everybody's toes to get ahead, I'm ignoring the woman in my life who married me. Because I was bigger than her. But she's at home taking care of our three beautiful children. I didn't even have enough respect for her, you know, because of me, myself and I. It was horrible. But what happened from that point on was life-changing. And you'll hear, because my life changed. Hands down, my life has changed dramatically, and there's only one reason it's changed. Well, two. One, I became willing to shut up, stop thinking, and listen to others. And two, I thank God every single day and every minute for being clean and sober and to have my beautiful children and thank Him for my children, thank Him for the sacrifice that He made. I never did that stuff before because it was all about me. Well, I'm going back and forth to New York, and I'm commuting through the World Trade Center for 16 years of my life. And one morning, I take my oldest daughter, who's now 15, to her first day of preschool in Hellertown, Pennsylvania, at St. Teresa's in Hellertown. And that was the morning of 9/11, 2001. And I was actually in God's house that morning. And I left school, and I'm driving in Manhattan. I was supposed to go in late that day because on Monday, I got a phone call at 4:05, and it was my boss out in San Francisco. And he said, "Paul, your daughter's first day of preschool is tomorrow. Why don't you take her to preschool? Why don't you take her to school? And then why don't you come in and make sure you're here by 11? I said, "All right, Tom, thank you. I really appreciate that." And that's what I did. And as I left the trading floor that evening, I went walking by. The last person I saw was my friend Mikey. I patted Mikey on the ass, said, "Hey, see you tomorrow, Mike." We lost five guys the next morning on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and Mikey was one of them, one of five people. And that was a tragedy in my life that I used as a catalyst to get sicker. That gun collection, that's when the gun collection got bigger, you know, and the ammunition was there and all of that, because I was psychologically, like, scared, full of fear. I commuted every day across the river to Manhattan looking at the World Trade Center smoldering and burning, and I just was full of rage, anger, and I wanted to just kill people, literally. I wanted to hurt people. If I was younger, I would have signed up for the military, family, no family. That's how much freaking hate I had in me. What happened, well, that was manifested into a solution of alcohol and drugs. Because the only way I knew how to deal with anything was to drink and drug. I never had any other solution in my life. When I was a kid, when I won a wrestling match, I drank. When I lost a wrestling match, I drank. When we won the basketball game, I drank. When we lost the when my mom and dad died, I drank. You know, everything was drinking and drugging because I had to escape myself. I could not be Paul. Because for one, I didn't even know who I was. And two, I didn't like feeling the way I was feeling. You know? And when I took that drink, that sense of ease and comfort always just swooshed over me. You know, that feeling like, oh, you do a shot of like some really hardcore liquor and you're like, oh, smooth, you know, like, oh, yeah, it burns like hell and you're like, smooth, give me another. Like, that's how crazy it was. And you know darn well it didn't taste good. I don't think it tasted good. I was full of fear, like I said, and pain. My solution was to stop buying fifths and start buying half gallons. I started drinking every single day. Then, this is how sick I was. February 15th of 2002, I was called in to my boss's office in the luncheon club of the New York Stock Exchange. We were all called in one at a time because it was bonus time. And my boss and his boss were in there, and they gave me my bonus for 2002, which was in 2002, which was really for 2001. And I'm not talking like, you know, I'm talking more money than I make in 4 years now, you know, 5 years, in 1 month, in one check. And I wasn't even grateful. I was like, yeah, but where's my raise? And they looked at me like I had three freaking heads growing out of my shoulders. And I don't blame them for looking at me like I had. I'm told I'm getting 150% of my annual salary, and I want to know where my raise is. That's how sick I was. I could not even be grateful for more money in one check than I make in 5 years today. So what happened was I continued down that path of destruction. And it got to the point where it got so bad, I went away on a vacation to Mexico with my now ex-wife, and a lot of friends, about 35 people on this trip. And I made such a fool of myself. And when we got home, she said to me, if you don't do something about what's going on with you, I'm taking my children and I'm leaving. And I was like, whoa, 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 they're our children. And she said, not if you don't do something about this. And I was like, okay. I was in therapy. I said to my therapist that, like, week, I said, you know what? I looked at him. I said, you know, George, I said, I think I might have a drinking and drug problem. And this therapist, who I'm paying boatloads of money, well, my insurance company's paying him boatloads of money, goes, hallelujah. And I'm looking at him, and I'm like, what's your effing problem, you know? And he goes, Paul, you have no idea how long I've been waiting for you to say that. And I looked at him, and I said, well, why didn't you tell me? And he started laughing. He said, Paul, you can't tell a drug addict or an alcoholic that they're drug addict or alcoholic. With your ego and your pride and your self-centeredness, you would have never have come back to see me if I told you I thought you were an alcoholic. And I know he's 100% right. I never would have gone back. He says, you would have ran from me like you've been running from everything your entire life. I couldn't agree with him more today. Then I didn't see it. Today I know it. That was the beginning. He pulled out a schedule of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, here, here's the schedule. It's Tuesday. There's a meeting tonight at 7 o'clock in Bethlehem. It's called the Mustard Seed. So I went to my first AA meeting on a Tuesday night, October 2nd, 2002. And I started on a path, like I said, of the dry variety. You know, I was white knuckling it, man. I was not going to drink. I was not going to drug, no matter what. But see, I had a third edition at that time, and I don't have it anymore. I think I burned it. But I wish I had it today, because I just wish I did. But I sat in that meeting, and I cried like a baby, because I didn't know what was going on. There was a young kid that was chairing this meeting, and he looked at me when I said, you know, is anybody new to AA? And he's like staring at me, and I'm like, what are you looking at me for? I didn't realize I was supposed to raise my hand. Like, I knew nothing. You know, alcoholism has been running rampant in my family through generations, and sobriety has never been discussed amongst anyone. AA was never discussed. No idea what it was. And he explained to me after the meeting I should have raised my hand and said, my name's Paul and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Now I'm learning a little something from this young kid, 19-year-old kid. So I start going to meetings regularly, and I don't drink and I don't drug, but I do absolutely nothing that is suggested. I don't take anybody's suggestions. I don't listen to any direction, and I'm just going to do it my way because I know better than you. And then one guy said to me, you just might have to quit that job on Wall Street to get sober. This guy, Glenn, he used to hand out candy all the time. I felt like shoving that candy right up where the sun doesn't shine. I'm like, what do you know? Guy's 35 years sober. I'm like, what do you know? I have to quit my Wall Street job. What, are you kidding me? Well, God saw fit to take the job instead of letting me quit it. That was the type of stuff that was going on. I built a restaurant right over here at the Quakertown exit back in like 2004 or 5. And we opened in halfway through 5, toward the end of 05. I was physically building the restaurant, and I had stopped going to meetings. And I decided that I was okay, that I didn't need meetings, so I didn't go anymore. And it was only a matter of time, as we tell everybody, it's only a matter of time. That restless, irritable, and discontent feeling is going to win unless we do something to get rid of it. It will win, always. I can't swear to God, but I'm telling you, I have not seen it not win yet in anyone. All right? I built this restaurant. We opened the doors. Now, whoo, look at this, man. I'm on top of the world. One day I'm sitting at the bar with one of my friends from New York, Kevin. And this tap is there with a German guy dressed in his German garb. I'm German. And this tap starts talking to me. You're all right. Now, at this time, I'm smoking. Got a couple things that you might put on the back, you know, stainless steel countertop with a credit card. But I'm not drinking. That was the key. See, I'm an alcoholic. I was not drinking alcohol. Till that day, the tap started talking to me. And I looked and I said, you know what? You're probably right. I said to one of my bartenders, I said, hey, give me that German guy right there. So I got a 16-ounce beer, and I drank it. And I went home. The next day, I go back to my restaurant. I say, hey, give me one of them German guys there. I drank it. I said, you know what? Give me another one. And I drank it. I have 2 pints of Frankenstein. And I drive home. Now, the delusion that occurs as I walk into the man cave in the barn and I look into the mirror and go, you're not an alcoholic, see? You drank a beer yesterday and you came home. You didn't have to drink another one. You drank two today and you came home. As I'm chopping a line. See, you're all right. You're not an alcoholic. Okay? That's what was going through my delusional thinking mind. It was about 6 months later that my now ex-wife walked into that man cave in my barn and found me smoking crack. She didn't know it, but there was a line of heroin on my counter. And I never smoked crack or did heroin before that period of my life. And earlier I said when I started doing heroin, I would stop. And I knew I had to do something. I knew I was on the path of destruction of death and I was going to die. There's no two ways about it. It manifested that fast for me. Like, boom, I was just sucked right in. So I said, okay. That week, 2 weeks later, I had to go to New York for an interview. So I went uptown Manhattan, I had this interview, and then I get a phone call from my nephew who was still on the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Hey, what's up, Uncle Paul? I said, well, I'm uptown on Fifth Avenue. I'm at an interview. He's like, well, why don't you come down to the trading floor and visit us? I'm like, yeah, that's a great idea. So I jumped on the train. I went down to the New York Stock Exchange, spent 16 years of my life there. I went in to say hello to everyone. While I'm there, my sister calls her son, and Jason's like, hey, Paul's here. She said, let me talk to him. So I get on the phone. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I was at an interview. I'm going to head home. She goes, can you come over here and help me? And I'm like, yeah, sure, of course I can. I hang up. I said, Jay, how do I get over to Mom's from here? She lives in West New York or East New York. I don't know. It's right along the river there and just north of Jersey City and Hoboken. And he goes, well, you just go down to the PATH train and get on the PATH train, take it over to Exchange Place, and they have a trolley now. You just jump on the trolley, and it takes you right up to Mom's. All right, cool. I walk to the World Trip to the Ground Zero, and I get on this PATH train. And when I sit down on this PATH train and it starts moving, I had this freaking incredible, overwhelming feeling of fear. And I was so scared. And my thought was, last time I was on this train was September 10th, 2001. And I was scared. I came out of the train on the other end in Jersey City, and I called my friend who never gave up on me. He would constantly call me and say things like, pot maintenance isn't sober. Click. You know, just constantly for years of that 2.5 year of me basically relapsing. I called my friend and I said, Lee, I got to get back to AA. I know that there's something there for me. I know there's a solution. So I came back to AA and I started going to meetings again. And I knew I had to do something different. And Jim's sitting right here. I'm at a midday meeting. Now, you got to understand, when I came back into the rooms, May 27th of 2007, my life was totally unmanageable, totally destroyed, lost the restaurant, on the verge of losing the farm, lost the Wall Street job. Everything is just unmanageable. But I think I've got the answers still inside my head because of the delusional thinking that we suffer from. And Jim meets me after a midday meeting one day, and he asks me, he says, looks me right in the eye, and I'll never forget it. I hope he remembers it this way because I do. But he just looked at me and he said, Paul, how long do you want to suffer? And he meant it. And I looked at him and I said, I don't want to suffer anymore. And I meant it. And he took me over to the hotline in Bethlehem. And I couldn't even read. And he read the third step with me. And I swore to myself, and my God, that day, I was going to do everything different. I was going to follow direction. I was going to take suggestions. I was going to get out of the way. Okay? I surrendered. I gave up.
I did not think normal. And it finally clicked. I am not a good thinker. Period. What I think is for entertainment purposes only. Done. And that was the beginning. And then I just started going to meetings. 8 months. 8 months of just complete insanity in my head, in my actions. I had a breakthrough, but I didn't move in the right direction right away. See, because Paul still was involved to a little bit of an extent. But what happened was the sunlight of the Spirit was shining through for me. And I knew I didn't die the morning of 9/11 for a reason. I was blaming God for 9/11 instead of saying thank you for having me in your house the morning of 9/11. I mean, what are the odds? The breakthrough happened, and I decided to start following direction. I got a sponsor. He was the best sponsor for me at the time. Brian passed away not long ago. I loved him. He was the first man I sat down with and shared my entire story with, and I left no rock unturned, and I kept nothing inside. He knew everything about me, and I was able to do that because he shared his story with me and told me crazy things that I never even did. And I thought, I can do this. And I did a thorough fifth step with my sponsor, Brian. He did it a little differently than what we do today in the big book. But what he did, it put the life preserver around my neck. And I wasn't sinking anymore. And I started doing the things that I needed to do for Paul and my sobriety. Because if I wasn't going to stay sober, all the other things around me weren't going to get better. No matter what I did. See, the fact that I wasn't in control sunk in. One of the greatest things I learned in AA is that I know absolutely nothing. And that, I know absolutely nothing. What I think doesn't matter. And that's a blessing. So somebody invited me to come to Feet First here at this meeting. And I walked in here. There was a greeting line. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. I sat down and I heard I think the speaker that night was a girl that lives down I'm not going to say Cuba, but the Dominican Republic, or she lives in an island down south, and she was the speaker that night. And she was talking about some things and sharing things that I wasn't hearing anywhere else. Like, I wasn't hearing them. And she was talking about, she had all these, like, slogans and, like, you know, like, I don't know. She just had a ton of these things that she was using, and they all made sense to me. But they were all about sobriety and all about doing the work. And doing the work as it's laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps, you know. And what happened was I realized, like, Brian took me as far as he could in sobriety with his knowledge. Because, see, we can only give away what we have, I believe, you know. And what happened was one day I was here at Feet First and I kicked over the coffee of a friend who's now my sponsor, this gentleman who I didn't even know. And I kicked his coffee over and I helped him clean it up. And Roy and I met that day. I met my sponsor and I just started talking with him. And he just had this peace about him. And found out we worked like half a mile away from each other down in Willow Grove. Coincidence, huh? So I'm like, I don't believe in coincidence, by the way. So I think I asked Jeff, and I called a couple people, and I said, you know, think about asking Roy to be my sponsor. It was a go. Do that. God said do it. So I asked Roy to be my sponsor. Within, maybe a few weeks, we're sitting down in his house, reading out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, first step, second step, third step.
We get to the fourth step, and he gives me the instruction to write down, as outlined in the big book, to write down my fourth step on paper. And then a few weeks later, we got together, and I did a second fifth step with Roy. And it was a little different for me that time. Like, I didn't hold anything back with Brian, but it was just different. And I didn't have this overwhelming, like, burning bush thing happen, you know? I left. We hugged. Fifth step's done. I left. We met a week or two later at Penn Foundation, sat in a gazebo, did 6 and 7 together. Never had this overwhelming thing happen. And then my ex-wife and I had split up. And that was pretty painful. But one day, I was still going back to the house to take care of our children while she went away to work. And one day, I went down to the computer, I hit the mouse, and the screen opens up, and her email's there, and it was open, and it was obvious that I was no longer the love of her life. And it was a very, very painful moment in my life. And what happened was I had left the house that day, and I was in so much pain, and I'm just calling and calling and calling people in AA. Roy didn't answer. You know, I just kept calling people until finally my buddy Staten Island Johnny answers. And I'm like, dude, you're never going to believe this. And I tell him everything. He goes, you're not thinking about drinking, are you? I said, I am now, thanks. You know? I hadn't been, but now I am. And he's like, well, that's not the solution. And I finally got a hold of my sponsor. And Roy just basically walked me through it. And he said some pretty hard stuff, man. Your wife deserves to be happy, joyous, and free, just like you. Okay. You did a lot of damage. You were very self-centered for a long period of time. You never cared about her before. And he was saying these things to me. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I manned up. I manned up and admitted to myself that the cards are being played the way they're supposed to be played. Nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. That week, I call my Monsignor. Well, like a week or two before, my friend Owen, who's an undertaker. Well, I don't know what the terminology is now, but a funeral engineer. But he says to me, he goes, Paul, he goes, how well do you know your new Monsignor at St. Teresa's? And I said, well, I mean, I know Monsignor Schroeder, but I don't know him. He goes, dude, he is the most spiritual. Now, this is a guy that knows all of the priests, all of the rabbis, you know, he deals with them all. And he tells me how powerful this man is, spiritually powerful. And I put that in the file cabinet. And when this occurred in my life, a flag went up, and I called my Monsignor. And I went in to see him. And it was raining, it was ugly, and I had my raincoat on. And I had young kids, so I had these cloth diapers, you know, the kind you wash and you use them again. I really like them for everything but what they're meant to be used for. So I had them, and I had them in my car, and I put one in my pocket. I went in to see Monsignor, and he said, Paul, how can I help you? And I pulled one of these cloth diapers out and dropped it on the table, and I looked at him. I said, I brought my crying rag. He says, I guess I should sit down. And he sat down, and I sat down, and I spent 2.5 hours doing a complete, thorough fifth step with my Monsignor. Because I was done. I didn't want to suffer anymore. I had nothing to hide anymore. It kept me so sick and in so much pain for so very long. I surrendered, man, and I did it again. I became completely honest, this time with my Monsignor. I dropped the F-bomb with this guy. And I'm like, oh, wait, oh. He looks at me, goes, Paul, relax. I've heard it before. Okay, all right. after I get done, and he's just like, my God, Paul, that's incredible. You have been through so much. But the only thing you didn't share is, did you ever cheat on your wife? I said, you know, Monsignor, no. I never did. I said, I had a love affair with drugs and alcohol, but I never had an affair with another human being. And he said, that's remarkable. And I just said, you know, it is what it is, you know. I do have some fiber of humanity, I guess. And now I have more. And I just keep working toward having more and more fiber in my soul. And when I left there that day, when I drove away from my church and I came down into Quakertown and I pulled off at the Hess station and filled up with gas, and I'm filling my car with gas and I'm crying, I'm in pain. Still, you know, the pain doesn't just go away, man. I'm suffering. My wife's got a love affair with another man, you know, and I got three beautiful children and, you know, everything else is in shambles. My phone rings. It's my ex-wife. And she says, Paul, are you okay? And I said, no, but I'm going to be. I said, thanks for asking, but I'm going to be. And she said, I'm really sorry. And I said, it's okay. And as I'm leaving the Hess station, driving down Route 309 at about 35 miles an hour because it was a torrential downpour day, all of a sudden, I'm begging God to take this pain and to relieve me of this pain and this suffering that I'm in. Because I'm still thinking about myself. Like, I haven't completely trained myself not to think about me yet. But, you know, so I'm still in a lot of pain. And all of a sudden, I had this overwhelmingly feeling and tingling in my feet. And then it comes up my legs. And it comes up through my stomach. And it felt like this big cloud of black smoke came right out of my head. And all of a sudden, I felt, whoa. I am going to be okay. And my phone rings. I look. It's my sponsor. I answer my phone. And I said, Roy, you're never going to believe what's going on right now. And he goes, why don't you tell me about it? And I go and tell my sponsor the experience I'm having as he starts crying, going, God is in your life. Period. He's got you. And he did. He had me. I just was too focused on me to realize it, ever. You know, I said earlier, I should have died two handfuls of times. I mean, I was in car accidents, and I mean, just crazy stuff. Why am I still here? I don't know. Maybe it's because there's one person sitting in this meeting tonight that's going to get something out of what I'm saying. I don't know, and I don't need to know today. All I know is I was not in work on 9/11. I'm still alive. I'm sober and I'm living a spiritual life to the best of my ability. And everything else is starting to really work its way out. You know, I used to have financial problems. I live paycheck to paycheck. Not problems, but you know, not having enough money is a problem to me, you know. So I got that little bit of a problem where I'm just living paycheck to paycheck, but I always have what I need. I just want for more for my children. But they're still in Catholic school. They're still getting their education. They have everything they need, too. And I have to take a step back sometime and realize that and just say, God, thank you. Thank you. You know? I told you my sponsor and I did 6 and 7 at Penn Foundation. My 8th step amends list, I have worked through my amends list, and I have about 3 or 4 amends that I really need to make that are still, you know, holding me. But there are 3 people that I have no idea where they are. And the 4th person's deceased, and that amends is my brother, and I don't have a grave site to go to. I constantly talk to him, but for some reason I feel like that's an amends I'll never be able to make because, I don't know, It was just a painful relationship. My brother was an alcoholic and addict, but he was never willing to admit it like I was. And he died. And very painful, very gruesome, ugly situation. But I don't know if I'll ever be able to make amends with him, you know. Like, I feel like it's still lingering always, you know. And if anybody has experience with that, I'd appreciate a little guidance. But, I mean, I've done what I had to do. I wrote him a letter. I read it out loud. I did all that. But for some reason, there's still that little hole. And there's three people that I just have no idea where they are. But I do know that someday when God puts them in my path, it's because they're supposed to be in my path. And if they're supposed to be in my path, then I know what I'm supposed to do. And when that opportunity arises, I will do that. 10, 11, and 12, I do on a regular basis. Okay? I pray every morning, every afternoon, every evening, pretty much all day long. Jeff called me tonight. I had just sent out a text message. Yeah, we got a great speaker at Feet First, you know, to a bunch of guys up in the valley. Thank God none of them are here. Because they'd be thinking, like I said, there's a great speaker at Feet First tonight, and I'm the speaker, when that wasn't the case, because we had a really good speaker coming up, but he couldn't make it, and that's why I'm speaking. See, here at Feet First, we don't really, as home group members, we don't speak. We bring speakers in, and that was an attraction for me to this group. Because, see, if I'm going to join this group because I want to get up here and speak in front of you, that's kind of ego-ish if you ask me, so... When I found out that, no, the home group members don't speak at this meeting because it's an ego thing. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. I had no problem making this my home group, you know. And then when I read the primary purpose for this home group, Feet First Speakers Group, primary purpose is to deliver a consistent message of hope and recovery through God reliance and service to others as the result of practicing the principles of the 12 steps as outlined in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, that's a no-brainer. You know, that's where I'm at. I feel that way. I love it. And that's why this is my home group. And I continue to come here. I've missed two handfuls in 4 years or so. Two handfuls of missed meetings. And probably a handful of those were because I was speaking somewhere else. You know? But I try to be here no matter what, ever. Nothing is going to stop me. And I try, to the best of my ability, to do what the book suggests. Yesterday, I get a phone call. A.A. Joe. Okay. I answer, hello. Hey, Paul. This is pain. I'm here. Oh, hey. How you doing? Not so good. I'm like, what Joe is this? I didn't know what Joe it was. Joe the electrician. I met you at Third Avenue. I'm like, all right. What's going on? And he said he needed help, and he was willing to take suggestions. Can I come and can I help him? And I was going to an all-day soccer tournament down in Upper Dublin, Pennsylvania, with my 12-year-old daughter. And I'm like, you know what? Let me give you a call back in 5 minutes. I get on the phone. I make three phone calls. The third phone call is the funeral engineer, the burial engineer. So I get Owen on the phone. I'm like, Owen, I need your help. Owen's in a place where he needs somebody to help. Like, this is all God. This is just like, bam, it just happened this way. I'm like, dude, this guy, he goes, is it Joe? And I'm like, yeah, how do you know? He goes, because I just got a call from some guy named Joe, and I don't know who it is. I'm like, I don't either. Call him. And he goes, I got to go. He's calling me again. And he hangs up. Owen takes this guy last night for 2 hours and keeps him from drinking. And today, another alcoholic picked him up and took him to a 10:30 in the morning meeting up in Catasauqua. Tonight, Owen's spending tonight with them. I asked them to come down here, but they already made plans together. I'm okay with that. But that is the power of this program. We can keep each other from killing ourselves if we're just willing to just be able to see that our way of thinking just isn't right anymore. It's just not working for us, you know? It's just not working. And when we are able to become honest and willing and open-minded to a power greater than ourselves, we have a chance. And we will survive. It's just that simple. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay, we have one small announcement.
An anniversary. My sponsor, Jeff, had an anniversary last Thursday, 29th, right? 6 years. And I actually thought since Steve was coming, I might see if you wanted to give it to you. And about 3 years ago, him and I sat down, and he started working the steps with me. And it's all been God dependence and step work. I give him 10-step calls that he pulls his hair out at. And the other night we were out at dinner. Was it on your? No, it was 2 days before your anniversary. And he's on the phone with a guy doing a 10-step call, and he's going on and on and on. And I'm like, I wanted to just take the phone and say, look, listen, I've already been through this with him. I'm telling him what to say because he says it to me all the damn time. Yeah, it's none of your business. So he celebrates 6 years, and he's a huge influence in my recovery. And God delivered him to me in prayer, and I have grown exponentially in 3 years more than I have the 9 years prior to that. So, congratulations.
Keep this short because I'm not known for talking a little bit at a time. Usually I'm known for go on and on and on and on. But anyway, I share Paul's sentiment about this group. I showed up at this group literally 6 years ago today. I showed up at this group. Ante was speaking. And I showed up here because my sponsor told me to. I met him on a Saturday. He got together with me on a Sunday and said, tomorrow, be at this meeting at 8 o'clock. And I said, where? And he said, in Quakertown. I said, dude, that's like a half an hour away from my house. And he was like, I don't care, be there. And I was like, okay, all right, I'll be there. And thank God I did. Thank God I was willing to do whatever he said to do. And, you know, all I can say is that it's been a remarkable path, and that I'm just so glad that he took the time to share a little bit about himself, for the sole purpose of allowing me to trust him enough to take some actions that I did not think were going to work. And as a result of those actions, they did work, and I had a great experience, an incredible experience that keeps growing today. And then I just try to do the same thing to the best of my ability with others, is share a little bit about myself in the hopes that they can trust me enough to take some actions that they don't think are going to work. And I think that's what this is really all about. So that's all I got. Thanks.
Congratulations, Jeff. The group would like to thank Paul for sharing his experience with us tonight.